The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
As you know, Catholic moral teaching, especially on marriage and all matters sexual, is fairly controversial, usually dismissed as retrograde and out of step. And we could just even say the generic traditional view of marriage, traditional morals as concerns human sexuality. The prevailing popular impression is, at least from the Catholic side, is that the Catholic teaching on the meaning and purpose of human sexuality is mostly about a set of arbitrary rules, mostly a set of prohibitions, whereby, you know, celibate old men just open the window and shake their finger to the world and say, don't do this, don't do that. And that, you know, at bottom is a disdain for human sexuality that Catholic teaching harbors, with sexual activity tainted at its core. The truth of the matter is quite different, however, because really at the core and foundation of Catholic moral teaching is a certain vision of being human. That is, a beautiful conception of the fundamental structure of the human person, or of how a human person is constituted. At the foundation of the Catholic vision of marriage and of moral teaching in general is an understanding of how God has designed us and how He intends us to live as a result, an understanding that is known both by faith and divine revelation and by reason alone, by philosophy. Catholic moral teaching flows not only from an understanding of this design, but a love for it, a love for how God has designed us and how He intends us to live. A good voice piece for this understanding, at least as it concerns our sexuality, is Pope Benedict XVI. Back in 2012, in a little-known address to the Roman Curia, Pope Benedict asserted that a, quote, new philosophy of sexuality had taken hold of Western culture, and that this new philosophy of sexuality calls into question the very notion of what being human really means. Still quoting Pope Benedict, Catholic moral teaching, for its part, simply articulates what is, quote, inscribed in human nature itself and thus accessible to reason and common to all humanity. And so that's what tonight's remarks is really going to focus on, what's inscribed in human nature itself and thus accessible to reason and common to all humanity. Catholic moral teaching as it concerns marriage and human sexuality is therefore at bottom, it's a humanist vision. That is, it's about what being human really means. And you only have to be human to get it. By proposing a vision of what being human truly means, Catholic teaching on marriage proposes a vision, dare I say, of beauty, of happiness, and freedom for the human person. I say this because marriage, of course, is not unique to Catholicism. It is a natural institution common to all human societies because embedded in human nature itself, even if it is assaulted in unprecedented ways in current Western culture today. If we're looking at marriage as a sacrament, which it is for Catholics, it doesn't do away with this. There's this principle in St. Thomas that grace doesn't do away with nature. It doesn't destroy nature, but perfects it. So the sacrament of marriage, then, will perfect what marriage is in its natural reality, its natural institution. And it does this by redeeming it and divinizing it, or, if you will, leveling it up. The natural meaning of marriage, indeed the very moral meaning and purpose of human sexuality itself, remains normative for any kind of sacramental understanding of marriage. So if you want to get marriage as a sacrament right, you have to first get the moral meaning and purpose of human sexuality right. And to get the moral meaning and purpose of human sexuality right, we have to get the fundamental structure of the human person right. So let's turn to that. The first and most foundational point to make is that the view of the human person that Catholic moral teaching adopts is that of a body-soul composite unity, a union of matter or physicality and spirit. We can call it an integrated anthropology or a hylomorphic anthropology. It's an Aristotelian inspired word that just simply means it's a union of matter and form. That is a union of body and soul. So what we're talking about here is not half and half, not equal part body, equal part soul. We're not talking about a sort of ghost contained inside of a body, but rather we're talking about a unified whole constituted of two fundamental principles, 100% matter, 100% body, 100% soul or form. It's a vision of being human that boasts a robust philosophical pedigree, principally an Aristotelian one. This language of matter and form, it's Aristotelian. And at the same time, it's a vision of being human that's culled from the biblical account of the human person. And Thomas Aquinas is famous, among other things, for bringing these two notions of the human person together. The one, Aristotelian, the other, biblical. And from him, it would pass to the Church's common tradition. And one finds it in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. One finds it articulated in various encyclicals. Before we delve more deeply into this biblical Aristotelian notion of the human person, especially as Thomas Aquinas articulates it, let's consider the rival anthropologies today. That is, competing notions of what it means to be human, competing visions of the human person. I suggest that we can point to two in particular, with each sitting at polar ends, opposing this biblical, Aristotelian, hylomorphic view of the human person. Both have been common prevailing views in the history of human thought up and down the ages, and both remain quite vibrant and popular options today. Indeed, just as the biblical Aristotelian vision of the human person provides the foundation of Catholic moral teaching, so, I would argue, that do these rival notions of the human person act as the source of the moral values of Western secular culture that predominate today, especially when we're talking about today's new philosophy of sexuality, to use the language again of Pope Benedict. So, it's crucial that we understand them. These rival anthropologies are easy to grasp if we see them in relation to the biblical Aristotelian vision of the human person as a body-soul composite unity. Painting in broad strokes, in the case of one, and sitting at one extreme, the human person is purported to be a body alone. In the case of the other, and sitting at the polar opposite extreme, the human person is held to be a soul alone, if you will. Since both rival notions of the human person deny one essential aspect of our nature, either the body or the soul, both can be considered and thus called fragmented anthropologies. So let's start with the materialist view of the human person, the notion that the human being is nothing more than a body, a physical thing entirely. We're different from the rest of the animal kingdom, say, only by our more advanced DNA design. This notion of the human person is held by many scientists and philosophers today. It's not new in the history of human thought. Some ancient Greco-Roman philosophers were materialists. But this view of the human person has become popular today largely on account of the dominant role that modern science and the scientific method play in modern society, especially as regards human knowledge and truth-finding. Think about it. In today's culture, for something to be regarded as objectively and certifiably true, what must we be able to say about it? That it is somehow measurable or verifiable through scientific instrumentation. So scientism and materialism fit hand in glove. The view that only the physical or the material exists and that all of reality can thus be known through the scientific method and explained in scientific terms. This materialist anthropology thus flattens out human life entirely. It's a reductionist anthropology, as it reduces all human action and all human purpose to this material world here below. It denies a spiritual dimension to human life, and thus a transcendent or vertical side to human nature. That is, there is no aspect of our nature that transcends the body or the material realm. If we're only a body, it's thus nonsensical to speak of the human person as existing for something beyond this world, namely, for the absolute, for the infinite, for truth, for goodness, for beauty, for God. It's also nonsensical to speak of there being a moral dimension to human life, indeed, to there being any real interiority to the human person at all. All human action is explained in terms of neurochemical phenomena. We act upon nothing more than just nerve twitches. And so, belief in God is reduced, say, to a part of the brain called the God spot. Human love is reduced to the neurotransmitter oxytocin. Note here, for clarification purposes, the issue is not that we're saying the human brain plays no role in our believing in God, or that oxytocin plays no role in human relationships. The issue is explaining belief in God exclusively in terms of brain activity, or holding that human love is entirely explainable in terms of the hormone oxytocin. The both-and principle, which is so foundational and endemic to Catholic belief, is at play here. It can both be true that the brain plays a necessary, albeit instrumental, role in our knowledge of God or any rational concept, and that the brain on its own cannot account for our knowledge of God or our knowledge of anything conceptually. It's not either or. Either the brain accounts on its own for our belief in God and for all rational knowledge, or it plays no role in our belief in God and conceptual knowledge. Either oxytocin determines on its own human love, or it plays no role in our relationships. Since human interiority is reduced to neurochemical phenomena in the materialist view of the human person, free will is an absurdity. And with no free will, there's no real responsibility over our actions. Our actions, our choices, are determined strictly by the physical laws of nature. By denying any real responsibility over our actions, we drain human life of all real adventure and drama, as well as romance. In particular, the great adventure, one of the great adventures of human life, the great friendship of marriage. Thomas Aquinas calls marriage maxima amicitia, highest form of friendship. In a materialist view of the human person, there is no such thing as friendship in the sense of freely chosen love, and thus the romance and the drama and the adventure that come with it. Most of our actions are constrained in one way or another, determined by neurochemical dictates, determined by nerve twitches, physical scientific laws alone. If that's true, it doesn't take much thought to readily see the moral consequences of this, in particular as they concern the human body. Since a materialist anthropology renders all talk of moral action, moral choice, and moral responsibility nonsensical, it eliminates all talk of the body enjoying any inherent moral worth and dignity. With the body having no moral worth or dignity, it follows that we can do whatever we want with it. We can treat it as a recreational playground. Hello, hookup culture and all forms of sexual pleasure, drug use, you name it. We can treat the body as a laboratory and subject it to scientific experimentation. That is, treated as a pure instrumental means and object of manipulation and control, especially by means of technology. Artificial reproductive technology, artificial contraception, physician-assisted suicide, gender-affirming care would be examples of such things that would be in play. So, let's move to the other rival anthropology, the view that the human person is a soul alone. We could call this anthropology Cartesianist, named after the 17th century philosopher René Descartes, the father of modern philosophy. You could call it a Gnostic, angelistic, or even dualistic, or even Platonic anthropology. But whatever the nomenclature, the human being is conceived in this manner, not as a body-soul unity, but as an autonomous thinking, choosing self, who is at best loosely or accidentally bound to a body, at worst imprisoned by a body, or pinned down by the body's evil. To cite Descartes, so Descartes is, he's on the softer side, that the body isn't evil, but it's not part of our human identity as such. And here is a classic passage from him to showcase this. He writes, "I thereby concluded that I was a substance whose whole essence or nature resides only in thinking, and which is not dependent on any material thing. Accordingly, this I, that is to say the soul, is by which I am what I am, is entirely distinct, reads separate from the body." It's Plato who would go further, who previously went further, looking upon the body as the prison or the tomb of the soul. And in Plato, we find ourselves in the foyer of Gnosticism or dualism, famous for their disdaining the body along with all things material as inherently evil. So according to this anthropology, the body, with its biological hardwiring, weighs upon the soul like an albatross and stands as an inimical threat or a rival to the autonomy of the thinking, choosing self. Seeking to explain the traction that this notion of the human person has gained in modern times, the author Wendell Berry observes how this view, quote, "looks upon the body as upon the natural world, as an encumbrance of the soul, and so hates the body as it hates the natural world. It longs to be free of it. Looking upon the body as completely malleable, this anthropology encourages us to exploit and conquer our bodies, if only to free the soul from its chains, or recast to fit unbridled self-will. Descartes himself expressly asserts that the goal is to, quote, make ourselves, as it were, the masters and possessors of nature, end quote, and by extension, the masters and possessors of our embodied nature. So as with the materialist notion of the human person, so with the Cartesianist one, we can readily see the moral consequences that ensue, especially as they concern the body. They are, in fact, the same as the consequences of the materialist anthropology, even if this anthropology sits at the opposite extreme of the materialist one. Your body is not truly part of you as a person, as a moral agent. You are not your body. It's thus not integral to your human identity. It's reduced to the subhuman. And since your responsibility as a moral agent belongs to you as a person, it follows that your body enjoys no inherent moral worth or dignity. Your body does not carry moral responsibility with it. So then, what can you do with it? Anything you want. Treat it as a plaything, as a recreational playground. Treat it as a laboratory or an instrument, as a tool for some other end, as an object of manipulation and control. Sex becomes reduced, along with the body, to the realm of the subhuman, and thus a matter of health. How many of you had your sex class in secondary education in a health class? And thus it's not worthy. Putting in a health class is to abstract all moral consideration from the topic. What I'm suggesting and trying to have you see, in other words, is that the modern secular approach to sexual choices and lifestyles, to use this example, is largely predicated, even if implicitly, on this Cartesian-styled anthropology. I'm not suggesting that, your average person on the street is reading Descartes, or has a card-carrying member of the Descartes Club. Rather, it's that ideas have consequences, and a Cartesian-styled view of the human person has sunk deep into the well, as it were, of Western culture, Western thought. It's in the air we breathe. It's in the water we drink, whether we're consciously aware of it or not. Don't take my word for it. Take Pope Benedict's. In the same address cited earlier, Pope Benedict noted that today's, quote, new philosophy of sexuality conceives of the human being as, quote, merely spirit and will, and denies the fact that, quote, bodily identity serves as a defining element of the human being. How else to read the current predominant attitude taken towards our biological design, our biological structuring, especially as it concerns sexual identity and the ordering to procreation? As for sexual identity and gender theory, consider what the plastic surgeon and first director of the Johns Hopkins Center Gender Identity Clinic, Dr. John Hoops, said of transgender individuals at the clinic's opening in 1966. If the mind cannot be changed to fit the body, then perhaps we should consider changing the body to fit the mind. Or consider what the American Psychological Association asserted in its report from a few years ago called Harmful Masculinity. Quote, the concept of gender roles is not cast as a biological phenomenon, but rather a psychological and socially constructed set of ideas that are malleable to change. So gender, on this view, is of the mind. It's not a matter of biology. We know the result of this. If you insist that one's sexual identity or gender remains essentially linked to one's biological sex, then we know what you can be accused of as a result. As regards the biological ordering to procreation, is it not the case that today this is largely seen as impertinent, if not outright hostile to sexual love, unless we choose to make it otherwise, and that it places no inherent moral obligation upon us? Sex is largely seen, is it not, as an affair of internal desire and love, with the biologically structured body standing on the outside looking in, save for the pleasure enjoyed? Consent, nebulously defined and provided by the self, the soul, meets the only necessary condition for morally acceptable sexual activity. Even if you turn to a certain group of Catholic theologians and moralists who disagree with church teaching on this, they harbor a Cartesian-like disdain for the body. And we know it because of how they speak. They speak in disparaging terms of what they term, quote, biological function and procreative processes. One, for instance, tells us that Catholic moral teaching is driven by an obsession with the mechanics of the procreative process. Another accuses the church of reducing sex to a mere biological function and of turning homosexuality into a barnyard animal affair. Again, this wouldn't even necessarily be exclusive of how Catholic teaching is viewed. It's just the traditional view of sex and marriage, whether Catholic or not. And we shouldn't be fooled here. This kind of language acts as nothing more than a ruse camouflaging an underlying Cartesian-like bias against the physical or biological order. Not mincing words, the same Pope Benedict, this time in his inaugural encyclical letter, Deus Caritas Est, God is Love, charges this approach to sexual practice as tantamount to a veritable, to use his words, debasement of the human body and a hatred of human bodiliness. So this brings us back then to what I mentioned at the beginning, the biblical Aristotelian vision of the human person as an integrated whole, as a body-soul composite unity that is at the bedrock of the church's teaching. Here, the individual person is as much identified with his body and or her body as with his or her soul. A paradoxical union of matter and spirit, the human being is yet one, not equal part. We're not centaur-like creatures, half-rational, half-bestial, with a clean line of separation between the two. We're integrated, unified beings, comprising both rational and animal or subrational dimensions. We are one. How is this notion of the human person biblically inspired? The Genesis creation account makes this clear, as we read in Genesis 2:7, then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground, that is a body, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, that is a rational soul, and man became a living being. Supporting this from a philosophical perspective is the Aristotelian view that all things, save God and the angels, are composed of matter and form, or material stuff arranged, or specified via the form into particular kinds of things, like how the material stuff of metal and plastic and glass is determined by a respective form to be either a cell phone or a laptop or a remote control or what have you. So you have these two. You have the Aristotelian philosophical account stands on its own. You have the biblical account stand on its own, but the two are eminently reconcilable. They're speaking the same voice. Aquinas, of course, would fuse these two biblical and Aristotelian accounts together. For him, the human person is a unified composite of organic matter, which is of an animal-like sort, and a rational form or soul, which is proper to us, unique to us. The human person is constituted of an animal body, dust from the ground, the language of Genesis, and an immaterial or spiritual soul, the breath of life, Genesis. The Catholic Church's common tradition has made this language its own, especially the Aristotelian language. For instance, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, citing the Council of Vienne, affirms the unity of body and soul. The unity of soul and body is so profound that one has to consider the soul to be the form of the body. Spirit and matter in man are not two natures united, but rather their union forms a single nature. This Aristotelian language of matter and form, it can sound pedestrian on its face, but it's super profound. Because again, we're talking, we're constituted 100% of matter and form, body and soul, but in different respects. Okay, so wherever the body is, there is the soul. The soul is the source of all the body's vital movements. The soul is the source of the body's very existence. The soul is that by which we are actually human. Pope Benedict says the same thing in Deus Caritas Est number 5. He says, it is neither the spirit alone, nor the body alone that loves. It is man, the person, a unified creature composed of body and soul who loves. And that's really what he's concerned about in the encyclical, friendship, love. Needless to say, by appropriating this notion of the human person, the Church holds to an elevated view of the human body. Aquinas himself, wishing to underscore the nobility of the body and aware that matter or body is for the sake of form or soul, asserts that the human body, because of its dignity of being fitted or designed for a rational soul, stands apart from all other bodies as the most excellent expression, quote, of the divine art. Think of the unique design of the hip bone, allowing us to stand upright and erect indefinitely, or of our larynx, or of our opposable thumbs, or two eyes in the front of our face, our hands free to free up our hands, free up our mouths to speak. You know, we're the only animals that has the tongue going down the back of our throat, which allows for complex speech. The design of our bodies, in other words, reflects or bespeaks our rationality, especially in its vertical design. By virtue of having a spiritual soul, we transcend the material and we're ordered ultimately up to God. We're on the vertical axis as well as the horizontal axis. Rationality is thus written into our very bodily design. For Aquinas, the human body is thus God's artistic masterpiece. It's his greatest work of art. In his great poem, The Divine Comedy, Dante, wishing to show that the human body is no mere husk or shell, refers to the human body as a radiant royal robe for the human soul. Human beings are not angels. We're not free-floating, disembodied spirits. Indeed, St. Paul himself gives the strongest language of all. The body is nothing less than the temple of the Holy Spirit, 1 Corinthians 6:19. The moral consequences of this, especially as they concern the body, are obvious. Integral to our human identity, the body enjoys inherent moral worth and dignity, since what we do to our bodies, we do to our very selves, we do to our very persons. To treat the body well is to treat ourselves well, and to abuse the body is to abuse our very persons. The immoral man sins against his own body, St. Paul tells us, and so follows with the charge to, quote, glorify God in our body, 1 Corinthians 6, 18 to 20. So, there we have it. Two distinct notions of the human person, with each defined by its distinct regard for the human body. Either the human body as God's artistic masterpiece, as the temple of the Holy Spirit, as the necessary counterpart to the soul, as matter always is to form, or the human body either as a barnyard-like, biologically structured accessory or add-on, or as devoid of a transcendent soul. If the former sees the human being as a paradoxical unity, as an integrated whole, the latter reduces the human being to a fragmented self, to use the term that St. Augustine employs when he describes his earlier life of sexual dissipation in his great work, The Confessions. Catholic moral teaching, to repeat, has cast her lot with the view of the human person as a paradoxical unity, since indeed it coheres with the biblical witness, a witness that is undergirded by a proper, robust metaphysics of human nature, an Aristotelian hylomorphism. What emerges from this integrated view of the human person is the entirety of moral teaching from the Catholic Church, inclusive of the meaning and purpose of sex, and also, if you want, of the sacramental meaning of marriage. So let's see how this plays out in the arena of human sexuality and of marriage. So our sexuality is expressive of our body-soul design in a particularly unique and privileged way. How so? First, that human sexuality follows primarily upon our body, upon our embodied, biologically structured nature. And this is plainly obvious. Because our bodies are of an animal-like sort, they are, by their very design, of a sexually complementary or binary sort, male-female, deriving specifically from the genetic karyotypes of XX for males, XY for XX for females, XY for males. Because we have animal-like bodies, we are sexed. Further, that human sexuality as an embodied reality is teleologically hardwired for a predetermined end, namely procreation, is also plainly obvious. Unless we wish to abstract biology outright from our sex nature, it's impossible to deny or dismiss this. Male-female sexual dimorphism, looked at the level of strict biology, targets procreation in the same way that, say, respiration targets the oxygenation of the blood. Pleasure is not the primary purpose of sex. Procreation is. Don't get me wrong, the Church doesn't think pleasure plays no role here or that it's bad. No, pleasure is part of God's design, and so is good. It's just not the primary good that our sexuality targets, but is subordinated to the higher good of procreation. Also, I don't mean to suggest here that procreation must always be intended for the sexual act to be moral, just that we respect the procreative design or ordering of the act. Stressing the ordering to procreation does not intend to signal either that sex serves no purpose other than procreation or to undersell this other purpose. As the human being is no mere body, so neither is human sexuality merely expressive of our embodied nature, nor ordered simply to a bodily good. After all, if we say human sexuality is ordered exclusively to procreation, we in no way distinguish human sex from purely animal sex. That we know there is a radically profound difference is betrayed by the distinctive phrase we use to signify sexual union among humans, making love, a phrase we would never use to signify sex among animals. Indeed, the very physical manner of sexual union among humans, namely frontal and face-to-face, unique in the animal kingdom, in its own way testifies mightily to this difference. Simply put, human sexual union is expressive not simply of a physical union, but of an encounter of persons, or what John Paul II's theology of the body calls a communion of persons. How else to look upon the bodily frontal posture of face-to-face than as expressive of a union that serves spiritual, moral, and emotional needs, in addition to physical needs? Human sexuality thus enjoys a per se ordering not merely to procreation, but also to a complementary love-making union. Because this latter ordering is proper to us as rational beings, as persons, moralists term this the personalist or the unitive ordering. You could call it the ordering to friendship, the union of friendship. We see then how human sexuality is expressive of our body-soul structuring in a uniquely privileged way. The procreative ordering of our sexuality follows immediately upon our embodied, biologically structured, animal-like nature, and the unitive ordering follows immediately upon our rational nature. And because body and soul are one, so must these two orderings always be together. The next step is a foregone one, then. Because sex, as owing to our body-soul composite nature, owns a twofold per se ordering to procreation and to unitive love, we can say it has an intrinsic teleological ordering to marriage. That is, to a union that is designed of its very nature to produce and rear progeny and to unify two persons of complementary sexual design in a union of friendship that is lifelong. Only marriage unites the procreative and unitive dimensions as corresponding to the indivisible substantial union of body and soul. Marriage thus marks the normative good of our sexuality. Sex is about marriage, which means, yes, it's for the mutual benefit of the spouses, but it's also for the benefit of children. The biblical witness reveals the same. So that's seeing marriage as sex is ordered to marriage on a philosophical level. We can see the same in the biblical witness in the first creation account of Genesis. We learn that God fashions us male and female for the express purpose of, quote, being fruitful and multiplying, Genesis 1, 27-28. That is, for the express purpose of procreation. The second creation account places the focus squarely upon what we've called the unitive or personalist dimension of human sexuality, in that God fashions the first woman to serve as a true companion or friend to the first man, Genesis 2, 18-24. Taken together, then, the two biblical creation accounts make clear that God has endowed his human creatures with a sex nature for the twofold joint purpose of procreation and unitive love. The Genesis creation account affirms that human sexuality is a gift from God, ordered to marriage, which alone joins the procreative and the unitive, for which reason Aquinas calls marriage maxima amicitia, highest friendship. Highest friendship. Put negatively, the body is meant for no other form of sexual intimacy than that between husband and wife in an embrace of procreative, unitive love. This biblical Aristotelian hylomorphic account of the human person and of how our sexuality is expressive of it puts us into a position to appreciate why Pope Paul VI, in his famous encyclical Humanae Vitae, number 12, famously insists upon, quote, the inseparable connection established by God, which man on his own initiative may not break between the unitive significance and the procreative significance. That's the money line, if you will, of Humanae Vitae. And now you can see how the various sexual practices that Catholic moral teaching considers immoral, any and all of them break in some form or fashion this inseparable connection by choosing the one, the procreative or the unitive, and exclusion of the other. Okay. So you've got, you know, you can just list, you got the procreative free acts, and then you have the unitive free acts. In either case, the result is the same, dehumanizing acts that deny our procreative unitive sex design and thus our integrated nature. These acts deny, at least in practice, the fundamental unity of the human person as a body-soul, procreative, unitive composite. And those who hold that it is permissible to separate the unitive and the procreative purposes of sex do so implicitly or explicitly on an appropriated Cartesianist or materialist view of the human person. Incidentally, if the ordering of our sexuality to marriage as a procreative, unitive institution is, as Pope Benedict says, inscribed in human nature itself, it should resonate with all people. So then, why is the meaning and purpose of sex so disputed? Well, in response, I hold up for your consideration The Sound of Music. All right. You've seen The Sound of Music. How many of you found yourselves rooting for the Baroness? You did? Okay. We got one. You know, why not more? She's beautiful. She's graceful. It's not like she and the captain share no affections, you know. Whereas Maria, how many were rooting for Maria? Why? She's quirky. She's this nun type person, you know. Right. So now, of course, the captain, you know, shares more in common with her. But let's just say, let's do a mental experiment. Let's say for the sake of argument that the nature of the relationship, the love between the captain and Maria and the captain and the Baroness is the same. How many of you would still give the vote to Maria? Let's say they love each other in the same kind of way, all right? What would, you know, you got to choose, you choose the spouse, the fitting spouse. How many choose Maria? Why?
She fits his family life.
Because of the children. The children matter, in other words, don't they? They're not, children are not incidental to marriage. They're not an add-on. Okay, they're essential to the meaning of marriage. So our culture has reduced the meaning of marriage to just the love between the partners. And the traditional view of marriage, this business that, you know, Catholic moral teaching makes of the procreative, is to say nothing other than that. Marriage is not simply about that. It's also about a family. It's about children. And that children are essential there. And they have, that also means the children have rights. Okay. So there we go. Remember that scene? They're trying to play ball with the Baroness. And she wants to send them off to boarding school. Remember that one? All right. Okay, so a nice segue to if you're considering marriage as a sacrament. Nice wedding scene that. All right, so the sacrament of marriage, it takes everything I've said about human sexuality and marriage and elevates it. It sanctifies it. Remember, grace perfects nature. Grace perfects the natural meaning of marriage. Marriage and sex, as it's inscribed in human nature, it perfects that. More specifically, the sacraments, St. Thomas tells us, have the power both to heal and deify. So here, the healing, it heals the way marriage and human sexuality, its procreative and unitive meaning, suffers from the effects and under the assault of sin. And to elevate marriage in its procreative and unitive reality to the level of the design. So let's zero in on how marriage bears the wounds of sin and suffers under the assault of sin, and thus stands in need of God's Christ-saving power. What about the procreative side of marriage? Yeah, kids are a burden. They're expensive. Well, this is what we're told all the time, you know? They're expressive. They're expensive. People look at you like you're from outer space if you have more than three. You know, I have five kids. And seriously, especially our first child was a daughter. Second child was a son. Then guess what everybody says? You're all set. All right, they'll cut you some slack if you have a third. But more than that, they're like, what? Why are you having more kids? They drain us of our time and energy, emotional reserve, and most of all, they make us confront ourselves vis-a-vis our own shortcomings and immaturity. I know one author who says the purpose of parenthood is to make us mature, to make us grow up, to get beyond ourselves, to stretch us beyond ourselves. Or consider how the anti-life culture that surrounds us weighs down upon us, making it difficult to live the church's pro-life vision of marriage and family. What about the unitive? It's never easy living with another person, let alone between men who are hardwired in their own way and women who are hardwired in their own way. Modern neurobiology has found that the very structure of the brain accounts in large measure for the distinctive hardwiring and thus the distinctive behavior of the sexes. The male and female brains are structured differently, with complementarity as the intended aim, as we're designed, you know, to match up for life. So when we throw sin into the mix and to our self-centered tendencies, and beware the Pelagian trap of thinking that we have the ability on our own to overcome these. There is also the inevitable dissipation of romantic feelings, mood swings, personality quirks, daily annoyances, and personal grievances, to say nothing of misunderstanding and miscommunication. Well, with all that said, do you think God wants us to have happy marriages? If yes, how do you know? Because he instituted it in its procreative and unitive meanings. We know this from the structuring of our very humanity, accessible to reason alone, and we know it from the Bible. So yes, God is the author of the procreative meaning of our sexuality and of unitive love, and thus of the highest expression of human friendship, of maxima amicitia. It's him who's designed, who has willed marriage be the highest form of human friendship. He created and instituted marriage for our happiness and fulfillment in life. He wants us to enjoy happy, fulfilling marriages. Does he know how much sin sabotages and seeks to torpedo the attainment of happy marriages? Absolutely. It makes sense, then, that he'd supply an antidote to marital sin. Who alone is the antidote to sin? Who alone has power over sin? Christ. This is what he proved in his death and resurrection. How does Christ communicate to us today the power that he has over sin? The Catholic response is through faith and the sacraments. Thomas Aquinas teaches the sacraments apply the fruits of Christ's death and resurrection to us. The sacraments of the Church derive their power from Christ's passion. Christ's passion is, so to speak, applied to man through the sacraments. The merit and power of Christ's passion operates in the sacraments. There are seven sacraments, thus Christ's power over sin is communicated to us in seven particular ways, tailored to seven human needs. Marriage is one of them. Marriage as a sacrament is thus God's guarantee of a happy marriage. Because that's how the sacraments work. They communicate Christ's justifying grace, ex opere operato. This is the language of the Council of Trent. It means they're guaranteed to give the grace they are intended to give by the sheer fact that they're celebrated in the way that Christ intends them to be celebrated, since Christ himself is the principal minister of every sacrament. He promises to be present in every sacrament, giving the grace that he wills to give. An equivalent expression of ex opere operato in St. Thomas is that the sacraments necessarily effect what they signify. So, what is the outward perceptible sign of the sacrament of matrimony? We speak of the sacraments as perceptible signs of God's invisible grace. In the case of marriage, it's the vows exchanged by bride and bridegroom. And what do the vows signify? They signify the indissoluble conjugal bond of Christ and his Church. So you see, the sacrament of marriage takes the natural institution of marriage and literally supernaturalizes it, making it no longer merely a natural bond between a man and a woman here below, but a procreative unitive relationship on par with the divine. The bridegroom becomes Christ the bridegroom, as it were, and the bride becomes the Church the bride. The bridegroom becomes empowered to love his wife like Christ loves the Church, and the bride becomes empowered to love her husband as the faithful bride, the Church, loves Christ. Want a happy marriage? Get this power. Ladies, you want a man who will love you like Christ? Find a God-fearing man and get married in the Church. Men, you want a woman who will love you like the Church loves Christ? Find a God-fearing woman and get married in the Church. And remember, the sacraments necessarily affect what they signify. They're guaranteed to give the grace they are intended to give. This means the man and the woman who receive the sacrament of matrimony are guaranteed a happy marriage. The Church offers the keys to a guaranteed happy marriage. Not a bad thing in a world of a near 50% divorce rate. I wish I'd say this at your standard pre-Cana or marriage preparation program. But let me be clear on how this guarantee works. And let me signal a warning. The sacraments don't work magic. The grace of a happy marriage is guaranteed in the sacrament, but this grace only bears fruits for those with living faith. If ex operato expresses the divine side of the sacrament, there's also a human side. Deriving the benefits from the grace of the sacraments requires on our part wholehearted deliberative effort and participation. not only in the period of preparation and the actual moment of reception of the sacrament, but also to the time afterward. We should not approach the sacraments like they're a faucet that we can just go up to and turn on at will in order to receive spiritual energy. And since marriage is a partnership, this wholehearted deliberative effort and participation is required on both spouses' parts. Crucial in the preparation stage is the duty to live in fidelity to this moral vision of human sexuality in marriage. So it means living chastely, avoiding all occasions of premarital sexual intimacy, including cohabitation. The goal here is not so much to observe rules per se, as to strive toward the true good of their marriage and toward the new beginning that their wedding day is intended to signal. It is no mere coincidence that those married couples who live in accordance with the church's teaching enjoy much happier marriages and an exceedingly lower divorce rate. After their wedding day, this extends to not contravening the objective moral law, you know, IVF, contraception, none of that, but it also extends to full participation in the church's sacramental life, regular mass attendance, regular confession, and to working diligently at their relationship, date nights, making time for each other, regular communication, forgiving each other, etc. To be clear, the grace of the sacrament of marriage promises, as it does, a happy, successful marriage, but that does not erase the effects of our fallen condition, and so does not promise that Catholic married couples will not encounter the hardships of married life. But what it does guarantee is that Christian married couples will not succumb to these hardships, that their marriages are guaranteed not to fail, since husband and wife are guaranteed the divine assistance to overcome their marriage struggles. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.